So we're going to pick up talking about kind of the things we look at on ethics and social justice. So we've talked a little bit about individual versus group rights. We've talked a little bit about ingrained and historic injustices. We've talked a little bit about common good versus individual good. And I think, you know, if you listened to the State of the Union last night, you heard the president talk a little bit about concepts of common good versus individual good. He talked about low-income workers for whom, and because remember we're doing this in the context of immigration, for whom illegal immigration particularly is an issue, because it does tend to lower wages in unskilled work. When there's unskilled workers, you can pay less than minimum wage, right? Mm-hmm. And I can talk about this a little bit. You know, when I was in college, one of the things I did to make money was I did roofing. And when roofing is unskilled labor, it's putting a nail in, you know, it really is. It's unskilled labor. All you have to be able to do is climb a ladder and hammer a nail, and you can put on a roof. And I got paid in the early to mid 1980s $10 an hour to do roofing. Because that was in the 80s, $10 an hour, because that was the going rate for roofers. And most of the people who did roofing in Ohio at that time were either college students or people who were construction professionals who were kind of, you know, making sure the college students were putting the nails in the right place. Now, the majority of people who do roofing in Ohio are immigrants from Mexico. And the average rate of a roofer in Ohio is $5 an hour.
Wow.
Which is less than minimum wage.
Wow.
So, you know.
And you could not get a U.S.-born person to do that.
Not for that amount of money, no.
No, that's what I meant. Yeah. For that amount of money, you'd have to pay them a lot more money.
So, you know, on the other hand, you know, we can't find U.S.-born people to pick beans and strawberries for any amount of money.
Right.
I bet the president didn't mention that.
Yeah.
Right.
So, you know, so the trade-off is you need to make sure you have enough labor, but you want to make sure. So when you talk about individual rights, common good versus the individual good, it's good for the individual who has a job and is making a lot more money than they could where they came from, but it's not particularly good for the community to have people working under the table, and also to have people who feel that they can't complain about working conditions. So if you're working illegally, what do you do if your boss is taking advantage of you? Mm-hmm. What do you do if your boss is...
Stuck. Can't do anything.
You can't do anything, mm-hmm. because if you complain...
There's somebody else there to do it.
Well, not only is there somebody else there to do it, but you could be sent back to...
Mm-hmm.
You have no recourse. One of the things the police say, that local police say, part of the reason a lot of them don't want to be involved in enforcing immigration orders is that it is not in the common good to discourage people from reporting crimes. Because if somebody breaks into your house and robs you or assaults you or robs you on the street and you feel you can't report it because you're here illegally, then you know, that's somebody who's going to continue.
And that just makes them a very vulnerable person over and over and over again.
Right.
Because it doesn't take long for everybody to know who you can hit without being told on.
Right. And it makes our society more vulnerable, because if I can get away with robbing somebody at gunpoint, then I'm more likely to rob people at gunpoint.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And eventually, it's not going to be just the vulnerable population. Also, it creates places in our communities that are more likely, you know, and it's not like, I mean, we're privileged enough that we can kind of choose where we go, but it's not like everybody has the privilege to stay out of certain areas, right? There are lots of people who have to go places because they have to go places. So, you know, that's when we talk about the common good, people tend to think, well, law enforcement is a common good, and yes, it is, but is having local law enforcement be part of the deportation process for the common good? Now, the flip side of that argument is the people who are here illegally, and they have violated the law to be here. So, what, you know, which law do we choose to worry about?
It relates a lot.
But some of the people who are here because of the reasons that they're supposed to be protected, and they're not. So the United States is not doing their job protecting people who are in desperate situations. So, you know, there's a lot of different groups to look at.
And particularly when you talk about criminal justice, one of the principles of American criminal justice is it's better for 10 guilty people to go free than for one innocent person to be imprisoned. But, you know, that, how does that then relate to effective?
Well, I'm thinking about how social justice relates to folks with mental illness. So it's by law enforcement. I don't know if I told you this, like circumstances. I picked up a ECC North list of classes, and they have the justice, criminal justice program. There were two courses listed for this spring semester, and the title of the both courses were Deviant Behavior. Now, deviant behavior is not necessarily mean criminal.
Right.
So I wanted to sit in. I wanted to audit one of these classes to see how they're educating these future officers in defining deviant behavior. So in terms of social justice, deviant behavior, if it's going to harm someone else, immediately, the imminent danger to yourself or someone else needs to be handled one way versus deviant behavior that's obvious through common sense and observation is mental illness. How do we handle that?
That's an issue. To bring it back to immigration, one of the issues in education, but also in law enforcement, is trauma-informed. Teaching and trauma-informed law enforcement, because someone who's been traumatized reacts in different ways than someone who hasn't. And often, and you see this both in schools and in law enforcement, often people who have been traumatized respond in ways that gets read as disrespect. Because
push back
or pull in are the two ways people respond who have been traumatized then respond to stress. Is either you kind of overreact or you dramatically underreact. And each of those things gets read as disrespect.
Yes.
Both by teachers and by judges and law enforcement.
And you don't think about either. If you're traumatized, you're doing something instinctive.
It's not a choice.
Some of that is cultural. Back in the 60s, well, we're still friends, but I have a very good friend who's Mexican, and her family came to Detroit probably in the 50s. She's an American citizen. So She became quite an activist. She worked with Cesar Chavez and that sort of thing. So she was telling me one time, and this was probably in the 90s, that when she used to be an activist in the court, she was a cultural translator for the Mexicans that came before the Detroit justice system. Mm-hmm. Because she said these people often hadn't done anything wrong, but they were misunderstood because culturally it was disrespectful to look you in the face. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So they would look down in respect for the judge and the lawyer and whoever else. Mm-hmm. But because they had been properly brought up, they would never look you in the eye.
And that got read as being untruthful.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And so then they would almost always be sentenced. Mm-hmm. It was more than disrespectful. It was lying. Mm-hmm. Because if you were not lying, you would look me in the eye and say that.
Wow.
Yeah.
And so she said she spent days and days for several years. Mm-hmm. As a translator for a couple of judges that realized this was happening.
The same thing's true in a lot of Asian cultures.
Yes,
that
I would
it
think
is,
so. Yes.
And it's hard to get the students as a teacher to look at you.
Yes, yes.
Especially people who never went to school before. I had a lot of Hmong.
Yeah.
They would be, I'd have to go like this, way down, and like under the table practically.
Yes.
See their eyes.
And now when we have the autistic people and we're so much more aware of them, how many of those of our own people and of anybody's people did we misunderstand and it was autistic because they didn't want to talk to you or even if they did talk to you, they wouldn't look you in
the
eye either.
They want to avoid eye contact.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. There have been instances where immigrants in this country when encountering law enforcement and told to do something, have no clue what's being said to them.
Right.
Yes. They don't know what you're asking.
Right.
About
exactly.
Them.
Yes. The English isn't good enough, or the we tend to think, oh, I don't have an accent, but we speak very quickly.
Yes.
Very fast.
Americans speak very quickly, and we also speak.
And Eastern Americans speak high speed quickly.
Yes. And we also speak very loudly. In a global context.
Yes.
It's one of the stereotypes of Americans is that we're loud.
Yes.
And we are, And part of it is because we're used to wide open spaces, right? Our homes are bigger, and so we are, a room this size is, you have to speak loudly to be heard in, but even in our homes, if you want somebody's attention,
Well, and we tend to yell a lot from room to room.
Until we start wearing hearing aids.
As I noticed on Super Bowl Sunday, hey, could you bring them?
Yes. Right. And if you're in a typical small house, in the rest of the world, and you yell from room to room, you don't have to yell that loud.
Right.
Response to talking to somebody who doesn't speak English is to talk louder.
Yes.
Because
isn't
you
that
think
funny?
It's going to get through if I just talk louder.
Right.
So
yes.
police or other social workers might
scare
people more by doing that.
Being around people that are not speaking English in itself. If I were a police officer in a situation where people are communicating in other than English, I immediately am almost on the defensive.
Right, right. You wonder what they're saying about you.
And it happens in my son and daughter-in-law's all the time. If her family is over, no one is speaking English.
Right.
And I'm like sitting there, and I'm resentful. Well, this is America. I'm here. I don't speak that language. Please, all of you, don't speak your language. Speak my language.
There's a wonderful story that makes the round on Facebook a little bit about, it takes place in the United Kingdom. And there's a guy on a train who hears somebody speaking, who sees somebody who's obviously not of English heritage, who is obviously from somewhere else, maybe not that person, but their ancestors, speaking on the train a language other than English, and he gets all indignant and says, "This is England!
Yes.
Speak English!"
Yes.
And the person next to him says, actually, this is Wales, and she's speaking Welsh. You know, but that, you know, that sense of, you know, and,
oh,
you
yes,
know,
yes.
And it's...
There's a similar one with the Native Americans.
Yes.
Native Americans encountering an English speaker.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. They were here longer.
Yeah.
Yeah, that gets to the point. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, actually, you're in the Cherokee Nation, and we're speaking Cherokee. Yeah.
Right.
So, so that's, you know, so these issues of common good versus the individual.
Big issues.
So, and we as Americans hold as a value individual autonomy, right? Individual rights, individual choice, individual autonomy. Mm-hmm. How do we balance that value against the common good?
And many countries don't have that value.
Right.
I know when I was teaching Japanese students, they're very reluctant to speak unless they're absolutely sure they're correct. Mm-hmm. So one of them said to me after class, she said, you know, it's very hard for us to say anything because when you correct one of us, you're correcting every one of us.
Mm-hmm.
You're correcting the whole group.
Mm-hmm. So the lack of individuality.
Yeah, they don't have that, and they don't understand, you know, Americans, American value.
Right. It's not even so much a lack of individuality. They would say that they have individuality. It's that their society puts a high priority on community. And so the whole community is learning together. So...
And feeling suffering.
Right, and suffering
feeling,
together.
Feeling a negative if you correct them. So. Mm-hmm.
And if we've read our Gospels, and our particularly our Old Testament, that sense of the whole nation is responsible is... That's the whole Old Testament. It's why God punishes the people of Israel for the actions of a few, right? It's why the law requires that the law of Moses requires that people be expelled from the camp for certain violations of the law, because you need to get that out of your community. The community is what's important. So this idea that the individual is sovereign is really a very American. It's now Western, but it's really a very American.
Yes, because you needed a community to survive, whether you were a tribe or one of the ancient nations. Mm-hmm. If you weren't a group, you weren't going to make it.
Mm-hmm. So getting back to the immigration issue, how... I, in some regards, I agree with... I can't believe I'm saying this.
Uh-oh, you're going to hurt my ears.
Well, you know what's coming. But there must be a way, a just way, of moving forward with a group of people coming out of Central America to us that who are so impoverished and so in danger. There has to be some sort of just way of dealing
with this. Well, this, I mean...
We can't just shut our borders. I feel we can't just shut our borders.
No.
We have numerous occasions.
My background, my relatives, you know, came, obviously, like a lot of us, away from, you know, poverty and oppression and everything. So why do I now, once I'm here, say, okay, I'm here, the rest of you aren't allowed to come in?
Because they're tinted differently.
Well, and that's also, that's true. I mean, and that flips back to the once ingrained and historic injustice. And we didn't always, but that ingrained historic injustice, that's a piece of it. But that sense of, I've got mine, now nobody else can have theirs, is also a very human thing.
You see that in that concept, you see in African Americans, mm-hmm. I'm here, I'm not reaching back for you, mm-hmm. because I made it.
You see it among
and
women?
Without anyone reaching, I mean, that was kind of like yeah. my father's mentality. Well, I made it, mm-hmm. so I'm not helping you to make it.
Mm-hmm. Because I did it by myself. Well,
yes.
you didn't. But,
yeah, exactly.
No,
exactly.
But you see it among women in corporate America.
Yes.
You know,
oh,
women,
gosh.
Especially
yes.
at the higher levels.
Yes.
So
yes.
the women who get to corporate boards know that there's one seat.
Yes.
For a woman
female, right.
and on so, that board. Yeah. And so yeah. I yes. want it, which means you can't have it.
That's right.
Mm-hmm. Right? So this mm-hmm. is a very...
Well, in the academy, from where mm-hmm. I spent 20 mm-hmm. plus years, yeah. that is so true.
Mm-hmm.
So true mm-hmm. about women mm-hmm. moving up. Yeah, mm-hmm. you don't help any other
well,
women.
That is actually a separate group, I think. Mm-hmm. You know, mm-hmm. I mean, those women are mm-hmm. very, very different.
When you
us.
Say immigrant, mm-hmm. you think of an adult. Mm-hmm. Yeah, when children
oh, yes.
are involved, it
yeah.
just
mm-hmm.
changes everything else.
It does. It changes the whole dynamic
yes.
when you're dealing
yes.
with a child,
yeah.
right? Because
right,
well, because children are generally considered not to be responsible for the actions that are imposed upon them. So, if your parent brings you here illegally,
okay.
that's not. You're not answerable for that because you're not old enough to be answerable for that. That's actually a very relatively new concept, the idea that children have lesser degrees of moral agency than...
Yeah, they used to be seen as simply miniature adults.
Right.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
Those of you who grew up in the Catholic Church may remember talking about the age of reason.
Yes.
Oh, yes.
Which is 7 years old. That really yes. dates from the 1600s. And that was a very progressive idea at the time, that before a child is seven, they can't be held responsible for their actions.
And for a long time, it was 9 or 12, I can't
yes.
remember.
Yeah.
Because you couldn't receive communion until
right.
you had reached the age of reason. And mm-hmm. my mother, it was 12.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it moved up.
Yes.
In
so by the
time.
Time we got there, it was... 7 or 8.
But for most of human history, that idea that children were in some way less responsible for their actions than adults was not a part of
yeah
of humanity.
Yeah, there's a more modern concept in law
right.
that juvenile protection mm-hmm. type of thing.
Mm-hmm.
That was one of the most moving things about that visit to the Blank Center
mm-hmm.
down there,
mm-hmm.
you know, comparing the treatment of the children on the
mm-hmm.
border
mm-hmm.
with removing child slaves from
mm-hmm.
their parents.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Well, and that mm-hmm. was one of the interesting points at the Underground Railroad.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Was that this is not the first time.
Yeah, child
yeah,
separation is
true.
Not... This
true.
Is not new in American history.
But we shouldn't be acting like people are slaves now.
Right.
But there
no.
are other cultures no, in the world that do take the children early mm-hmm. into separate mm-hmm. groups away from the parents and
mm-hmm.
raise them. It,
mm-hmm.
Not as a bad thing, a negative
mm-hmm.
thing, but
mm-hmm.
something they believe
mm-hmm.
Helps the whole.
Yes, upper class English people send their children away to boarding school at 6.
Well, I was
yes.
thinking of books as well.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, their children are
mm-hmm.
generally in a little group by themselves.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think in the Arabic culture, the boys are schooled, you know,
mm-hmm.
together and alone.
Mm-hmm. I think that's true.
And the girls are not schooled.
Mm-hmm. Well, mm-hmm. now they're schooled. But
differently, though, about the things that they need to know about.
I was looking up a quote from Bertrand Russell that
mm-hmm.
I came across back in the, it's been the early 80s, about, you know, the things that he looks for, the things he has always looked for or yearned for or searched for in life, about the longing for love, the searching
mm-hmm.
for love. But at the end... He talks about the feeling of just despair for the unbearable suffering of human beings.
Mm-hmm.
And so when you think about this issue down at the border,
mm-hmm.
it's hard to get my head around those children
mm-hmm.
and what their world, what they could possibly going through, and the trauma, the
mm-hmm.
lasting trauma.
Lasting, that's
the
thing.
Lasting
post-traumatic
trauma.
Syndrome that
they'll live with.
Yes.
They're all
yes.
going to live with, yeah. and how do they survive that? I mean, mm-hmm. how do they thrive with something like that?
Back mm-hmm. in the 80s, mm-hmm. Another good friend of mine adopted two children from, have I told you this?
Oh, yeah.
Adopted two children from Guatemala. Mm-hmm. One was an infant, and they were brothers, mm-hmm. technically, mm-hmm. we think. But in hindsight, we have a lot of questions. Mm-hmm. So the baby was like maybe 7 months old. Mm-hmm. The older one was 8. Mm-hmm. And the older one just never acclimated. Mm-hmm. Except when he was asleep, spent all of his time like this, keening. Mm-hmm. It wasn't crying, it mm-hmm. was the old Irish term of keening. Mm-hmm. And he would just go on and on. And this was for, my experience was for years, every time I saw him, he was doing this. Mm-hmm. And they got help, they tried everything. And it just never went away. Mm-hmm. In hindsight, we suspect that it was a legal adoption between mm-hmm. adoption agencies and mm-hmm. all of this kind of thing, one of mm-hmm. the big foreign adoption groups. We think that the family gave mm-hmm. him away.
Mm-hmm. Or sold him.
Yes, mm-hmm. yes,
yes.
That knowing, mm-hmm. or signed him off because they didn't know what the statement said that they signed. They mm-hmm. were just given yes. papers right. and mm-hmm. had to sign mm-hmm. it. Uh-huh. And children of these ages were being kind of herded mm-hmm. into these adoption agencies. So we feel that either his mother or his aunt mm-hmm. was still very much alive, mm-hmm. and that he just wanted to go back.
Mm-hmm. My niece, that my sister and brother-in-law adopted, we know her mother's alive. They actually have met her mother when they went to pick her up, but her mother couldn't feed another child.
Yes.
And so surrendered her for...
My father and his brother were given mm-hmm. away. My father mm-hmm. was born in 1919. Mm-hmm. His brother was a little older. Mm-hmm. They lived in Lockport. Mm-hmm. They couldn't, when he was early grammar school, the mm-hmm. parents could not feed the boys. Mm-hmm. So they were given to a childless mm-hmm. aunt and uncle mm-hmm. in Buffalo. Mm-hmm. And I really, to this day, believe my father never got over that trauma. Mm-hmm. I mean, he suffered. He was an alcoholic, but he suffered from bouts of depression. So he mm-hmm. he dealt with his depression, you know, mm-hmm. with his binge drinking and everything. But so the trauma of an early age, like we're separating the children mm-hmm. at the border, mm-hmm. those children will act out that trauma mm-hmm. probably till they die. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So what, you know, we're not helping our society by separating mm-hmm. these children. Mm-hmm. You know, that's such a harm to our society mm-hmm. because they will probably mm-hmm. be either in Mexico or United States incorporated mm-hmm. into the society with mm-hmm. all that PTSD.
Mm-hmm. Right. It's costing a lot of money.
Lot of money.
Yeah. You've moved me into option for the vulnerable, right? Which is the next thing that we think about, is that if you're thinking about social justice and you want to evaluate your society, one of the things you look at is what are the options you provide for the vulnerable? Huh. And so before you can answer that question, you have to, of course, think about who the vulnerable are. Well, we've talked about children. We've talked about the mentally ill.
But anybody culturally different than you? Mm-hmm. Uh-huh. If your point is vulnerable mm-hmm. in your space mm-hmm. is vulnerable, you mm-hmm. in their space are vulnerable. Mm-hmm. So it just depends on mm-hmm. whose space you're inhabiting.
Mm-hmm. I lost you on that thought.
Well, if
the minority,
the Mexican is vulnerable because they won't look at you mm-hmm. when you're accusing them of something, then you in their society, if you're right. if you find yourself in their society instead of them in here,
yeah.
then you're vulnerable because you're looking them right in the eye, and whatever that...
And they're perceiving you as incredibly rude,
yes.
And you're likely to be
disrespectful
and...
But so let's get back to that concept of that social justice.
Mm-hmm.
The term social justice would mean that a society needs to come up with...
Right. A just society needs to have options for the vulnerable.
For all the vulnerable.
Yes.
From the child who is mm-hmm. failing to thrive
mm-hmm.
to the senior citizen
mm-hmm.
who's living alone with Alzheimer's.
Uh-huh.
Mm-hmm.
That's exactly right. A just society takes into account the vulnerable populations and creates options for them. You see why social
Absolutely.
Justice is so difficult.
Absolutely.
And often because the needs of the vulnerable populations conflict.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yes. Oh, absolutely.
So what is a good... So, for example, we highly value individual agency. So, I'm going to flip
yes.
from immigration to medical
yes.
care,
yes.
okay? So, one of the values in our medical system is the patient is the determiner. So, the individual has the right to privacy and to make their own decisions. And so, the system is built for that. And particularly for the elderly, that's a group that would often have their agency challenged, right? Because they aren't living independently anymore.
Value
right,
to
exactly.
our society.
But where's the line?
Yes.
Where's the line when you actually need to have an option for someone who cannot exercise their own agency anymore?
Back to the mentally ill.
And for the mentally ill, also, there's, you know, things where there's a gradient.
Oh,
you know,
yeah.
Where's,
oh, absolutely.
It's not like there's a bright line that says, at this point, you can no longer
absolutely.
Manage your own affairs,
yes.
make your own decisions. And is there a difference between being able to manage your own money and making your own decisions about what treatments are...
And you would not believe the New York State laws
mm-hmm.
that stand as barriers.
Mm-hmm.
to that whole situation.
Well, and the reason the laws are in place is
to protect
the vulnerable, because, you know, the horror that our laws are designed to prevent are mm-hmm. what happened in the late 1800s and the early 1900s, when if you were slightly different,
yes,
you could be institutionalized against your will for your whole life.
Yes.
But you get
right.
somebody
so,
to test that. So mm-hmm. someone comes to the house, and the test is, can you say what day of the week it is and who's mm-hmm. president now?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, you're fine.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, my father in the nursing home, as he was beginning to lose it, he mm-hmm. knew it. And he would have the subscription to the Buffalo News
mm-hmm.
delivered every morning.
Mm-hmm.
And so before the nurse would come in and ask him his questions,
yes.
he had
yes.
his answers.
Yes.
He knew
yes.
who won the baseball game
yes.
last night.
Yes.
He knew who the president was, and he knew what the date was.
Well, and if you're, you know, if you're smart enough to figure that out, then you're probably okay to make your own decisions.
Yes, he's in middle ground right there.
Yes.
So,
between yeah.
But that's...
He was, but he knew enough to protect himself.
That's great, yeah.
And again, in our society, we value yes. individual agency.
Yes.
And individual autonomy.
And he was valued, even in
so,
the they all talked about
you know.
Years
mm-hmm.
later.
But I want to know, you know, if this came up at my NAMI board meeting
mm-hmm.
last night, I want to know what society in the world,
mm-hmm.
and let's say we'll narrow down to developed countries,
okay.
do have programs in place that protect the vulnerable? I mean, is it Sweden? Is it Norway? Is it, you know, Denmark?
I guess.
I mean, you know?
Yes and no.
Is
I mean,
it
it, it, well,
is
it depends.
It socialism? Is it, what is it?
It depends on what you mean by protect. You know, a lot of socialized countries take the pendulum more to the side of, we're going to provide you treatment whether you want it or not. more less socialized countries, the pendulum moves to the, we're going to allow you individual autonomy until it's absolutely clear that you can't exercise it.
Well,
so where do you land on that pendulum of what's...
I wrote a letter to the editor about this issue about Larry, the homeless guy, because I would see Larry all the time. So Larry refused to go in when it was like minus three. But instead of using the tools that they had, they said, okay, Larry, we're not going to take you against your will. You can stay out here and freeze to death. I mean, there has to be common sense where people make these decisions.
The problem about using common sense as the guideline is...
A lot of people don't have it.
Well, and but also...
It's a very nebulous feeling.
Right.
What does that mean?
There is a way in place. There is a way in place to help someone who themselves are vulnerable but don't understand that they're vulnerable.
Right, but remember, in our society, now we can argue about whether it's just or not, but in our society, the ultimate value of our society is the individual autonomy, individual rights. And so anything you want to put in place that as an option for the vulnerable, as an option for the vulnerable, comes up against the primary value. If the primary value of our society were... community harmony, let's say, then then it would be very easy to put in place things that would remove anybody who challenged community harmony. But we have, as a society, decided that the most justice sits in the right of the individual to make decisions. It's actually, the principle is called subsidiarity, which means that the decision is made as close to the individual as possible.
Subsidiarity.
Don't ask me to spell it. I can't do that.
I can't spell either, so I'll put it phonetically.
Yeah. Subsidiarity.
Subsidiarity.
Which, what that means is the decision is made as close to the individual as possible.
So, for example,
The unit of government that deals with maintaining the streets is the town, right? Or the village, or the city. We could make the state responsible for...
The closest to the individual is the
town government. And the town government is able to manage the streets of the town. Now, the throughway is managed by the state. Now again, it's an interstate highway. It could be the federal government that were responsible for that. But what we figured out is, well, we can't really have the town manage that because it goes through too many towns and there are too many places that aren't, you know. But the state can handle that. It doesn't need to be the federal government. It can be the state. So we push things down as close to the individual as possible. That's why education is handled at... Hi.
Can we interrupt for...
Absolutely. Hi, guys.
Hello.
What do you say? Happy birthday.
Oh, thank you. Is this me? Oh, did you all make me cards?
Yeah.
Thank you so much.
We'll give her all of them, honey.
Oh, my goodness. Pictures are. Oh, those are so great! Thank you all.
Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday, Pastor Vicky. Happy birthday to you.
Oh, thank you all so much. These are so cute. For me.
Very nice.
So I blew them out earlier. Thank you all so much. That's so wonderful.
Happy birthday.
Thank you. individually.
That was so adorable.
All right, so what I was saying, subsidiarity. So that's...
Subsidiarity.
Subsidiarity. That's the principle, is that... Now, the political debate in our country between Democrats and Republicans is actually where that line is. Democrats tend to think that there are more things that are handled better at the federal or state level. Republicans tend to think that there are more things that are handled better at the more local level. Right.
And taking so, that to your road metaphor.
Right.
When you drive around Western New York and you go from town to town,
it's really clear, right?
You can
really tell
work and which town doesn't put as much fund into it makes a huge difference.
And the reason for that is the theory anyway, the political theory is that people have more influence on the levels of government that are closer to them. So that 20 of us going to the Clarence Town Board will have more influence than 20 of us going to the state government in Albany
or the county
government, the county legislature.
Something else.
So that's the reason for this, is that the theory is the decisions that most impact you should be made at the level of government closest to you so that you can have more influence.
And that worked just fine when we were all very much parochialized little communities. But as with the whole world, it's a global area now.
Right.
So now people in Clarence don't just work in Clarence.
Right.
They work in Buffalo.
And
they work in Orchard Park. They work in Newfane. Yes. So each little town being the only ones that take care of their roads is not a complete solution.
Right. And this is the argument about education, right? That when we were an agricultural society, having the local community make the decisions about education was perfectly fine because the kids you were educating weren't going anywhere. They were going to be in your community.
Right.
But now we're competing globally.
Yeah.
So does it still work to have the education decisions made?
I just read a very interesting book about it. It was called The Woman Who Smashed Coke. And she and her husband both were in the very, very beginning of the coding, breaking codes. And it came to World War II. They've been doing this since before World War I. And when Pearl Harbor happened, some code breakers, they knew that something was going to happen. But they didn't know where exactly. But they weren't really allowed to say anything about it anyway, because they couldn't say anything about anything. But
it would panic people?
That was just the code. You couldn't say, you couldn't
share
their information. They couldn't even share their individual information with one another.
Oh, wow.
But the question that was raised was, would it have been better for any one of them to make it known that something was going to happen if they had been able to save all those people who died at Pearl Harbor, or would it have better, as this happened, to let it go, and in the case saving more thousands of people?
There's a similar case in England during World War II. The codebreakers at Bletchley Park found out that the Nazis were targeting a particular troop ship. And they allowed the attack to happen because if they had changed the, if they had stopped it, the Nazis would have known they had broken their code.
Exactly. Well, and that's the book we read.
Right.
Yeah,
So those are issues. We're 15 minutes past our time, so I'm going to stop. These are things to think about. We have two more to talk about in the context of immigration. The care of creation and solidarity.
The care of...
care of creation, that is the world around us, and solidarity.
Oh.
So we'll talk about those two things next week in the context of immigration, and then we'll talk about where you want to go from here. Okay?
So this is your birthday cake. So